In 1994, the Palestinian intellectual and literary scholar and a dear friend of mine, Edward Said, was diagnosed with a particular form of leukemia. He rang me up and said, I'm dying. I could die any minute. And do the last interview with me. This interview, edited for this version, was the result. One of the things Edward said in the course of this interview, when I said, what did the year 1917, 100 years ago, mean for you? For me, I said, it meant the Russian Revolution. For me, replied Edward, it meant the Balfour Declaration and the decision of the British Empire to create Israel. And I never forgot that remark, which explained the differences between us in upbringing and also, of course, the whole way in which Palestine was obliterated and a new state created. Re-showing this interview is a tribute to Edward, whose works still remain extremely important, and who, had he been alive, would have had many a harsh word to say about those who now equate any criticism of the Zionist project with anti-Semitism.
What are the first memories you can recall of Jerusalem?
Well, the house, principally, which my family lived in until we left at the end of 1947 in West Jerusalem.
Why did your family leave Jerusalem?
Well, most of my family left Jerusalem because they had to. Our house was in an area that was totally unprotected, and it was in an area that fell to the Haganah in, I think, February of 1948. There was, to my recollection, there was no militia. There was no organized resistance of any sort. There were homeowners in a prosperous but sparsely settled Arab suburb of West Jerusalem. In fact, all of West Jerusalem was Arab. That's not known because we hear about East Jerusalem today. But at the time, the four big districts of Arab Jerusalem, of West Jerusalem were Arab. And we lived in the most sparsely settled one. And by the time the fighting began, in the latter part of 1947, it became impossible to live there. And there was a general sense of panic. And my family left at the end of December of 47.
So, and how did you take the shift from Jerusalem to Cairo? Did you prefer Cairo as
I preferred town? Cairo. I mean, Cairo for me was, first of all, a much bigger city. It was a city in which I felt more at home. But in Cairo, one felt one was part of a large culture, of a large civilization. It was very European and Arab at the same time. And I felt also that I was able to develop more in Cairo by being exposed to the culture of the city.
Tell me about your father, Edward. What sort of a man was he? What did he do? What effect did he have on you?
My father was a quite remarkable man about whom I don't know very much. I've always found him rather mysterious. He wasn't very expressive. He had come to America from Palestine in 1911 to escape the Ottoman draft. And he spent about 8 or 9, maybe 10 years here, including a couple of years in World War I, when he served in the American Expeditionary Force in France. He acquired American citizenship, and he came back to Palestine in, I think, 1920. In relation to me, he was very severe. I had four sisters. He was much more partial to my sisters. And for him, I was constantly to be reformed. And in many ways, he focused on certain parts of my body. For example, my back, he was very upset at the fact that I didn't have a military posture. So there was a lot of my childhood was devoted to training my back, training it, he would say, and so on and so forth. So there was a lot of that. There was always my mother, who, of course, counterbalanced it. You know, and she tried to spoil me, but my father usually won out.
Why? What did he feel about your mother's?
Well, I think there was the idea that my mother sort of humored my waywardness. All of the things that matter to me today. Music, literature, ideas, really, I owe to my mother and to my relatives. My mother was my closest companion of my youth. I was given a lot of books as a child. I was a lonely child. And the books that I found it easiest to sort of lose myself in were the English novels. The first of which I read was Robinson Crusoe. I remember very clearly reading that in a wonderful illustrated edition. And once I started, I never stopped. I read, by the age of 14, I'd read huge amounts of Scott. I may have read all of Scott, I don't remember, but I just read all the time, and I read novels, basically, and what was available.
The three writers who've appealed to you a great deal, about whom you've written a lot, Conrad, Kipling, and Camus, were all outsiders writing about a society into which they had come for a variety of reasons. Right. Is this a sort of coincidence?
I think it is. I mean, I wasn't conscious of it at the time. The first of the writers whom I encountered and read, well, I had read the Jungle Books when I was a child. But I had a very bad experience with them because I associated it with my experience as a scout, where, again, I was a delinquent. I was an English scout in Egypt. I was always being punished.
An English boy scout in Cairo, right?
But my eyes were opened when I read Kipling later as a novelist, especially Kim, which is one of my favorite books. But Conrad was the first one I really sort of fell into. When I was, I think, about 17 or 16, I read Heart of Darkness. And I think it changed my life. I knew nothing about Conrad. And it was strange. I didn't really understand his background and what he was about until maybe 5 or 6 years later. But Heart of Darkness bowled me over. And I was mystified and taken up with his prose, which was obviously not English. I've never believed that Conrad wrote English. And I just took that as a matter of fact. And the more I discovered about Conrad, the more I read. By the age of about 20 or 21, I'd read literally everything he'd ever written. Then, of course, I knew that he wasn't English and he was an outsider. And I didn't make any association with myself, although obviously he was answering to some very deep affinity that I felt with him.
But, Edward, why do you say he didn't write English?
Well, because there was something, I mean, it reminded me of English written by people in my part of the world. It wasn't the English of the English, right? It was too insistent. The sentences were too long. At first, I thought he was translating from French. I believe
really?
That, yes. I mean, but there is a kind of Proustian quality to his prose. His inability to ever get to the point. I mean, it's a comic thing. I mean, you know, Forster made fun of him. Too many adjectives, too many sort of going, and James, all of them sort of laughed at him for that, but admired him at the same time. You realize that he's really not in the tradition or the mold of sort of the sort of direct speaker that he, in a certain sense, inherits from, you know, from Fielding and Defoe on down through Dickens. The speaking voice is a foreign voice in Conrad.
Now, I was going to ask you why your family, given who they were and where they were, had decided to send you to America and not to Britain.
Well, there were two reasons for that. One is that my father was an American citizen.
Yeah.
And he felt that since we had inherited the citizenship from him, that America was the place. Although we had no contact with it, I mean, I'd never been here, I should be sent here. But the other, no less important reason, was that I had really become a quite serious failure in the English system. In those days, we were talking about the late 40s now and early 50s, the English schools, the British Council schools, like Victoria College in Cairo and St. George's in Palestine, were hooked into the GCE, to the Oxford and Cambridge School Certificates thing. And I had been academically, as well as temperamentally, at odds with the system. And in the early part of 1951, I was thrown out of Victoria College for disciplinary reasons. And it was then felt, correctly, that my future in that system was really jeopardized.
How did you feel about being sent here?
I was terrible. I don't think I've ever really recovered from it, because it was the final, for me, it was the being severed from everything I knew and everything I liked. Despite the miseries of my childhood, or the rigors, let's say, of my childhood. But coming to America to a puritanical New England boarding school, I'd never seen snow before, to a completely different environment, which was puritanical and to my mind, hypocritical at the same time, with people whom I'd never had anything to do with, Americans whom I hadn't really encountered before, was shattering and disorienting. And I felt, for the first time in my life, that even though my character was very questionable and I had all these moral flaws as well as physical flaws, That was a known quantity. In America, I emerged as a completely different person, and I had to sort of make myself over again into something that this system required. The environment, the political environment of my early years at Columbia, those four early years from 63 to 67, was essentially apolitical. There was the Vietnam protest. But whenever I tried to participate in that and bring up the question of the Middle East, it was always put aside, you know, that this is an inconvenient thing. We don't want to... And then when the war broke out in 1967, I was desolated. I was in New York at the time, and I was completely shattered. The world as I understood it and knew it had completely ended at that moment. And it was shortly thereafter that I began for the first time, I had been in America already for 15 or 16 years, and I began for the first time to be in touch with other Arabs. I was completely a creature of an American and even a kind of a upper class kind of WASP education, Princeton and Harvard. There were no Arab students taking English literature. All of them studied Middle Eastern things, and I had very little to do with them, or they were in the sciences. But after 67, there was an attempt by the few Arabs who were around here to get together, mainly at first to contemplate the disaster, you know, the tremendous catastrophe of 67. But by 1968, which for most people represents the great student revolutions, in one going on in Colombia, where I was. But for me, I associated not with the student revolutions, but the beginning of the Palestinian resistance movement. And so by 1970, I was completely involved. I had started to write in this country, and I was immediately politically involved, up to my neck.
When did you first meet Yasser Arafat?
I met him in Jordan, in Amman, in 1970, in the latter part of August. But it was a very perfunctory meeting. I shook his hand, and that was about it. But I met him for a long period of time when he came to the United Nations here in November of 1974. And he had the speech that was cobbled together, and I was asked by him to put it into English, which he gave at the General Assembly. And then from then on, I started to see him regularly. And we had many, many meetings over the course of the next 8 years until... the last time I saw him in Lebanon was in the spring of 82. He was in bed. I went to visit him in one of his mysterious residences. He seemed very, very ill. And I said, you know, it's quite clear to me that the Israelis are going to attack. And I'll never forget what he said. If he said, if they want to attack, ahla wa sahla, welcome to them, let them come. Suggesting that he could
deal with it.
And I knew from a very close friend of mine who had visited the South and looked at the PLO defenses and so on in the South, and that the likelihood of anything but a catastrophic defeat was remote.
But what were the first impressions he made on you as a leader, as a politician?
Oh, I was very impressed with him. I remain impressed with him. He was very, very intelligent. And he always gave you the impression that he was trying to learn. In my case, he typed me from the beginning as an American. He didn't understand that America, one could be an independent, and one could speak for one's own ideas, and that I was a Palestinian, speaking as somebody in solidarity with the movement, and quite the contrary, a critic of American policy. He never understood that. He thought that I was always, there was always a program, an American program, and I was typed as an American, which is very hard. And for a long time, I thought that he understood what it was that, in the end, I was trying to do. But by the last days of his stay in Beirut, I realized that it was really hopeless. By the time he got to Tunis, where I started to see him almost within 3 months of his arrival there, I saw that he was a different man, that the loss of Beirut and the institution was beginning to crumble. He was grasping at straws. And it was by the middle 80s, I was convinced that he told me. I didn't quite know how serious he was about this. And he said, I don't want to be like the Mufti. All was correct and give nothing to my people. I'm willing to do something for my people, to get them something. In 88, it was the compromise to recognize Israel and to accept a two-state solution. I was for all of those things. But I didn't realize how far he was willing to go. It's certainly further than I would have gone.
So, just to recapitulate, the 67 war radicalized you, made you very interested in what was going on.
Right.
And pushed you in that direction of becoming a Palestinian spokesperson.
Right. Arab at first.
Arab.
Before Palestinian.
Right. And Orientalism then grew out of that.
Absolutely.
Of that new commitment.
Yes, because one of the things I was able to do, and quite methodically, was to clip and start to read what was written that didn't correspond in the West, which is where I was in 67 and after, which didn't correspond to my experiences of what the Arab world was really about. And I saw the various distortions and misrepresentations that I began by the early 70s to realize were systematic. They were not the odd, ill-informed or prejudiced journalist, but they were really part of a much larger system of thought in which these distortions were systematic and endemic to the whole enterprise of dealing with the Orient and the Arab and Islamic Orient in particular. So that's really what I did for the first few years of my political engagement, was to write and to expose and to contrast what I took to be the reality or the greater reality of the lived experience of the Arabs and the Palestinians in contrast to what was being written about them.
And then moved back into history.
And though at the time I wrote, for example, The Question of Palestine, there were no histories of Palestine. I mean, I had to reconstruct the history, partly. Well, I had to deconstruct the official history that one saw in the Western press and in Western scholarship, and then somehow try to advance a notion of what our history was. And I did it largely through the optic of what Zionism did to us. That is to say, we were the effects of Zionism, which is not a correct way of doing it, but it was all that was available to me at the time. And I think it was at that time, really, that I became much more convinced that the study of literature, for example, was essentially a historical enterprise, not just an aesthetic one. I still believe in the role of the independent role of the aesthetic, but that it could be just aesthetic, I think, is simply wrong. And literature for its own sake, the kingdom of literature, the republic of literature, all of that, I think, is complete nonsense. I think that the historical is really what dominated my thought at that time.
In your writings on music, you discuss the whole question of Wagner, his operas, and partially polemicize with Adorno from the Frankfurt School, who also wrote a great deal about that.
Right.
Now, on one level, one can agree, I mean, I myself love his operas, and in some ways he's the most intellectual of the composers. And yet there is the other nagging doubt, is what are we watching or what are we listening to? The politics of his operas is very clear, for law, for order, for the reassertion of authority.
Well, is it that clear? I'm one of the people who doubts it. I mean, it's certainly, if you look through his prose writings, of which there are a great many, he was a revolutionary. He was
in his youth,
but even in his later years, he was also revolutionary when it came to the stage. He had the strange ideas, for example, about building Bayreuth, which he did. But one of the strongest emphases in his later career is the idea that nothing should be permanent. And the one suggestion that he actually made is that the idea is to put on a festival of, let's say, the Ring at Bayreuth, and then burn the opera house down. So the idea of law and order and permanence and stability is completely foreign to him, because if you look at the end of The Ring, it's very unclear as to, for example, what that's all about. The gold goes back to the Rhine, but the Rhine overflows everything, and there's a kind of universal flood, and we're back to square one. So it's hardly a restoration of order. And I think the only way to take Wagner is as somebody who's fantastically volatile. And to put him on today in the style in which, in a rather confused way, he was trying to introduce, say, in Bayreuth, is folly. He has to be taken ironically, and I agree with Adorno about this. You can't put on Wagner straight. There has to be some angle in which the deep contradictions of his outlook and his music are highlighted rather than flattened out in some system of one kind or another.
Edward, in one of your recent books, the book on music, you've written, and I want to read this to you, "No social system, no historical vision, no theoretical totalization, no matter how powerful, can exhaust all the alternatives or practices that exist within its domain. There is always the possibility to transgress." Now, you've written this about music, but it applies to virtually everything, doesn't it?
Yeah, because I mean it really as a kind of social fact, that there's always an opportunity, no matter how one feels oneself sort of up against the wall and there's no other alternative but to, say, submit, which is usually what it's all about in the end. There's always an opportunity to do something else. There's always an opportunity to formulate an alternative and not either to remain silent or to capitulate. And I think it's the most important social precept for me, and really, in a certain sense, sort of governs, in my opinion, my understanding of politics. Because if politics is simply, as it's supposed to be, according to neorealism and pragmatism and all the other schools that sort of rule the day, if politics is simply the art of the possible and the art of the conclusive and the art of the compromise, I think it's the role of the intellectual always to be asserting the alternative.
But isn't it the case now that increasingly the public intellectual is a figure who seems to be disappearing? I mean...
Well, no, not disappearing at all. I mean, it seems to me the world is full of not so much intellectuals, but I call them experts and professionals. And that is, I think, the great threat to intellectual freedom and intellectual performance, is the extraordinary pressure placed on one to commodify his or her skills, expertise in a given field, like foreign policy, or foreign policy about Africa, or foreign policy about India, or foreign policy about Latin America, right? And by virtue of that, then belong to a community of experts whose whole role is selling their wares to the establishment, that the principal goal in mind is not to tell the truth or to say what the alternative to the present impasse is, but rather to maintain the status quo. So it's not a question of public intellectuals disappearing. I mean, Kissinger's on television all the time.
Yes.
Brzezinski's on television all the time. Paul Johnson is on television all the time. These are public intellectuals who talk the language of the marketplace, who represent the ideas of power that rule the world in which we live.
But Sartre and Bertrand Russell are known.
Exactly. It's that kind of... It's a dissenting intellectual that I think has disappeared, largely because the system neither wants to nor can, in the end, accommodate this person.
But your views on Palestine were pretty unpalatable to the establishment in this country.
Yes, I mean, and they are even today, with the onset of the Palestinian-Israeli peace accord. I mean, I've long been an advocate of negotiation and of peaceful settlement through negotiation of this conflict, with the necessary compromises. But I never advocated a settlement that was principally dictated by Israel and the United States at the expense of our history, because I think one of the things that intellectuals have to do is to remind this basically ahistorical, forgetting world, you know, which is basically packaging the news in 17-minute segments, of the history and of the people who suffered and of the long-standing moral claims that communities make when they are aggrieved, to remind them of this fact. And now that there's been a so-called peace in effect since September of 1993, it's virtually impossible to say anything critical of it.
And are you pretty pessimistic about this process, Edward?
Yeah, I mean, I think pessimistic is not the right word, because in the long run, I have some faith that as a people we will climb out of it. But I'm extremely upset at the current, what lies before us. We have a leadership. I hope I'm wrong, but just on the face of it, knowing what I know, both about ourselves, our leadership, the realities on the ground are such that we have accepted, we have signed on the dotted line, to something that effectively guarantees the Israeli occupation for the foreseeable future. Gaza, which the Israelis are very anxious to get rid of, has been vacated largely by the troops, and Palestinians are very glad about this, as of course we should be. But the fact needs to be remembered that they still retain 50% of Gaza. The troops are still there. They've just redeployed. Jericho is a tiny spot in the West Bank. You know, it's separated from Gaza by about 90 kilometers, all controlled by Israel. Jericho, the total area that the PLO is going to get limited autonomy in, is about, I would say, 60 square kilometers, you know, a population of somewhere between 10 and 12,000 people. And if you could make a state out of that, then you could probably, you could make horses out of butterflies. It's as probable as that. The main idea is to try and by bluster, in my opinion, to say that we have a state and to keep putting pressure on the Israelis, who are not going to be able to enforce every provision in the agreements they've made with the Palestinians, to give up. But it doesn't work that way. We're dealing with an organized society. We're dealing with a modernized economy with great military power, technological resources, the power of the United States, which backs Israel, as against what I think, at best, will be a reproduction of the situation in Beirut, where we'll have a few offices, PLO offices, a semblance of autonomy, but no liberation, no independence, and a series of 10 or 11 little cantons on the West Bank, all controlled by the Israelis, where Palestinians will be allowed to live like natives in Bantustans.
Is there anything, when you think back, that you regret not having done at any stage of your life?
Well, I do regret very much not spending more time on work that I'm trying to do now. But I'm very, very interested in writing a kind of what you would call documentary fiction, you know, of the years in which I grew up. Not because of the fact that I grew up in them, but because they still mean a great deal, I think, to the contemporary scene. The years of early nationalism, the years of political struggle in the Middle East, and above all, for me, the question that haunts me, which is I'd like to myself try to treat it, is the question of betrayal. I mean, I think the betrayal of promise, the betrayal of early ideals, has so much colored the history of the last 20 years, not only in the Arab world, but especially in the Arab world, that I would like to spend more time working on that. The first thing I did when I discovered that I was ill, after I came back from the doctor, was to sit and write a kind of letter to my mother, who had been dead for about a year, just to put in writing feelings that I would like to have shared with her. And in a certain sense, to try to revive a continuity which I felt had somehow been ruptured. And then thereafter, I thought it was important to memorialize this rather special world, which was not only my mother's and my father's and my sister's, in prose, which I'd never done before. And I did it for no particular reason, which was very important for me, that I wasn't doing it to fulfill an intellectual obligation or a commission or a political need or something of that sort. It was just an excess somehow, something that I wanted to do.
Was it also in part to leave something of that world for your children?
Yes, I, in fact, shortly after my mother's death, I began to plan to take my children to return to the Middle East. They had seen, of course, Lebanon, had been as young kids there frequently, but had never been to Palestine and never been to Egypt. So we took several trips, and I was very anxious somehow to establish a kind of common bond with them in Palestine, where they could see the house in which I was born, although I couldn't go inside. It was, I think, my biggest regret is that when we saw our house in Jerusalem, the house I was born in, all I could do was point to the window of the room in which I was born. But my daughter said, "Don't you want to go in?" And I said, "No, I really can't go in. It was just too much for me." And then we went to Nazareth and saw my mother's house. And that was a kind of sentimental occasion, but it completed things for the first time in my life in a way that I had never planned or tried.